bill be heard a little about. And the first witness listed is Chief Justice William Perry.
For the record, my name is William C. Perry, Chief Justice of the Board of Oregon. I don't know that I can tell you too much, because I think most of you know my feelings that the people of the state of Oregon are entitled to better treatment than they're getting now from our court. And it's purely a matter of the, I think some of the attorneys here are laughing. I think they've had some bad treatment sometime. But as you know, we are getting behind, and the Judicial Council took this problem up. We held meetings all over the state, and the bars of the various counties that we heard from were all in favor of it, except in Josephine County, the member from Josephine County that attended was just opposed to it. He had no, offered no solution, and they weren't sure, just sure why they were opposed to it. Lake County sent a representative, and they felt that the Supreme Court should be enlarged. The study was made by 95 representative citizens of the state, and at a meeting they later polled some 2 or 3 months afterwards, and after, I presume, visiting with other attorneys and so on, approved this bill 100%. Poll was 100% favoring the bill. As you know, various bar associations were contacted and also endorsed it by the Bar Association, and at the State Bar Association it was approved by the bar, by the Committee of Bar. We're going to not have a long hearing, and Justice Holman, who has been studying this and is prepared, will explain the bill. Any of us will answer questions, any questions you have as to the matter.
Any questions, Mr. Perry?
Mr. Chairman, it isn't a question, but he mentioned that the members of the Citizens Committee on Courts had, after a study of this matter, been polled, and I received a letter just this morning that indicates that they met on March 5, which was sometime after their first consideration of this, and that all of those who formerly were opposed to this intermediate court, and all those with doubts, had become convinced that the intermediate court was the best method of avoiding the serious delays that have occurred, and that they, as was stated, unanimously approved this. I've made a few copies of the letter since it came up this morning, and I'd like to give some.
No, I think it didn't show any copies of what I mean. Any other questions, Justice Guy, Senator?
I interrupted there for a minute. Senator Johnson wanted to ask Judge Perry to hear the opposing bill. Justice Perry, other than the fact of the additional year and a half of delay, which we'll get into, but do you have any comments concerning making these positions elected to excel in 1970 elections in the Department of Senate?
Well, that would be quite serious, the year and a half. But Yes, I do. And I think that you know that a lot of qualified lawyers that would accept a position appointed to this court would not run in a general election. That's one reason. The other reason is that you're going to start anyone out at quite a handicap if they have to make a statewide election and spend a lot of money to be elected. I'm sure that you're going to find that you're going to have a limited group of seats. Especially under the old retirement plan and
thank you very much.
Yeah. But really the delay is bad.
Justin Coleman.
Gentlemen, I'm here and dual capacity, and not only a member of the court, but also I am a member of the Judicial Administration Committee of the Oregon State Bar that was the principal instrument in giving birth to the plan that we have now. This matter has not only been studied by the Judicial Administration Committee of the Oregon State Bar and approved by the membership of the Bar Convention last September, but it has also been studied and approved by the Judicial Council and by the Citizens Conference on Courts, as Judge Perry has remarked. Before I go into the discussion of the merits of the matter, I would like to give you a little history on the background of our Supreme Court. You all know, of course, there are presently seven members. We are authorized by a constitutional amendment which was passed in 1959 to use temporary judges from the circuit court. We've been regularly using nine judges for some years now past, and have been unable to keep up with that number. The last increase in the regular size of the court was in 1913, when it was increased from five members to seven. That was the year before I was born. At that time, there were 22 circuit judges trying cases and generating business for the Supreme Court. There now are 58. Judge Dooley was the last one, number 58. To give you some idea on how our business has increased, in 1960, there were 394 appeals filed in the Supreme Court. In 1968, there were 629, or an increase of approximately 60%. This morning I was looking at statistics from the state of California, and they've had an even more rapid increase than we have. In 10 years, theirs has doubled. I don't think ours would quite do that with 75-80% in 10 years, I guess. Now, by this, I do not mean that because 629 appeals were filed, that the court has to write 629 opinions. A certain percentage of these goes by the board as a result of settlement, as a result of dismissal for technical matters, faulty and perfecting appeals, and things of this kind. And as a result, about 40% or a little better become dismissed in some manner that does not require mature consideration by the court. This leaves, as near as can be figured presently, the necessity of about 360 written opinions per year to keep current on the present basis. A study was made by a legislative interim committee appointed by the governor of this state in 1957. I happened to have been a member of that committee, concerning the then congestion on the Supreme Court and other matters in connection with the administration of justice. And also, a study was recently made by the state of Washington relative to the number of opinions that a justice of the Supreme Court should write if a fairly high caliber of opinion was maintained. And the answer came out approximately the same in both studies, was substantially 30 opinions a year. The national average of the Supreme Courts and the states, of the states in the United States that do not have an intermediate court of appeals is 27 per judge. Last year, the Oregon court averaged 38 opinions per judge for the 9 people that were working. Now, so much for, you can see the reason that we're basing our request for judicial manpower on 12 judges of 30 opinions, 360 opinions a year, to keep current. Now, so much for the need involved. So far, frankly, there hasn't been much opposition concerning the need. Most of the opposition has come from what do you do about admitting the need. And I would like to discuss that for just a little. There have been substantially two different plans suggested. Actually, the committee, the Bar Committee, studied more plans than this, studied 3 or 4. But it seemed to have developed down to the present plan that was submitted and a plan whereby the present membership of the court was to be enlarged and departmentalized. I would like to discuss the relative merits of this for just a moment. In the first place, if you're going to increase the size of the court, you have to keep in mind that if it takes 12 judges to keep current now, and all probability it's going to take 15 in 5 or 6 years, it will probably be 18 in another 5 or 6 years. Whatever we do now, we should build with some idea to the future. And as an example, California had once adopted the plan of enlarging the Supreme Court indefinitely. They would now have 52 judges, 45 appellate judges, except for Supreme Court judges. Also, if you once get a bunch of Supreme Court judges, I don't think there's any denial that eventually you'll have to go to the Supreme Court regardless of what you do now. It seems a trifle impractical to get yourself loaded down with 12 or 15 Supreme Court judges, or even more, because if and when you ever did go to an intermediate court of appeals, I don't know what you would do with the extra ones. I have a bunch that surplus Supreme Court judges would kind of stick around and stink up the landscape, and there wouldn't be any convenient way to get rid of them. You never get rid of a public official. You just acquire more, has been my observation, and I'm afraid it might be this way. Yes, we got rid of one when Holman was promoted.
It's the only way we can correct the mistake.
Yeah, it's like a flip. Yeah, I'm glad you said the legislature and not the people. Now, if you develop a Supreme Court in the department, you naturally tend to get into the problem of what do you do when you get opinions, conflicting opinions coming out of different departments. Now, this is permissible in an intermediate court, and virtually all intermediate courts in existence work in departments of three, because there's someone sitting over the top that can settle the conflict between the parties. But if they're, the final say-so, I don't see a very handy way of resolving the conflict. Now, actually, the Pressman Court has been operating in a semi-departmental situation. And that is a situation in which we screen cases in advance. We hear some of them with 7 men. We hear some of them with 5. We hear some of them with 3, depending upon what we think their relative importance would be upon the body of the law as a whole, not necessarily whether it might be reversed or whether it would be affirmed. A rough study indicates we reverse as many 3-man cases as we do 7-man cases. The cases we consider will not make any new law. However, every person on the court is obligated to read that opinion and criticize it, even though he may not have a vote. He is obligated to study that opinion, read it, and be ready to criticize it at conference. And just recently, we had a 3-man case in which I happened to be on the 3-man panel. I think the 3 of us were probably of an opinion so far as the case, at least I know 2 of us were. But when all the other members of the court looked at it, they decided that in all probability that might not be the opinion of the 7 regular members of the court, so we were sent down for another argument before the entire court. In other words, it keeps different opinions from coming out of different departments. But that imposes the obligation upon each judge to read everything, the output, and criticize the output of every other judge. And if you get any more than 9 members in any one court, this is virtually an impossibility because you spend so much time reading what the other man does and criticizing it and looking at the law relative to it. It's just not very practical. Statistics indicate that there's only one court in the United States that operates more than 9 men on the Supreme Court, and that's the Supreme Court of Mississippi with Ash 12. There are 5 states with 9, and the bulk of the balance are between 7 and 5, with a few having less than even that. I received today a letter from the president of the Oregon State Bar reporting, Mr. Yurkovich, reporting upon some inquiries that he had made from the California Bar relative to this problem. And it shows that what we are doing now is nothing new, that people have done this before and made the same sort of kind of rat attraction in the snow that we're making now. I'd like to read you part of the letter. Wednesday, I talked to Sam Pruitt of Los Angeles, president of the California Bar, and also Ralph Kleps, San Francisco administrator of the California courts. I am advised that they now have 45 intermediate courts of appeal judges who have jurisdiction over all appeals and review by the Supreme Court. And review by the Supreme Court is by petition and is at the option of that court. First-degree murder convictions automatically have appeal direct to the Supreme Court. I might add that there's no necessity of that in our state because we've done away with the death penalty in California still has it. This system, with the exceptions, operates like the United States Supreme Court. Historically, well, this is the interesting thing, historically, California has tried to dispose of appeals by use of commissioners and by dividing the Supreme Court into 2 divisions or panels. Neither of the latter 2 were satisfactory, and the present system was adopted. Originally, the California Interim Court of Appeals had restrictive jurisdiction similar to our proposal, to your proposal. Later on, when the volume increased, all jurisdiction was given to them. In other words, they started out with a partial court of appeals, and we're proposing now. And it has this benefit. And the final court in any system basically accomplishes 2 things. And you have to keep this in mind. 1, it decides cases. 2, it decides the policy and tenor of the law. Now, a multiple Supreme Court with 20 or 30 Supreme Court judges on it, working in panels of 3, say, would be admirable for the purpose of deciding gross numbers of cases. This would decide disputes quite quickly. However, it would be a horrible instrument for the purpose of trying to determine any policy of law for the state, because you would have too many departments doing the same thing. And you who are members of the bar, as most of you are, I don't have to tell you that there are some differences in philosophy so far as appellate court judges are concerned as to what the results should be in any one situation. I don't have to call to your attention the fact that the same thing that gives you as legislators different ideas as to what the law may be, everything that ever happens in your life, also has some effect upon the law as you make as a judge, because your values may be different as a result of different life and environmental situations and experiences. Frankly, on the court, when we screen the cases, we find that about 30% of the cases that we get are cases in which we feel that there could be a legitimate difference of opinion as to what the legal answer should be. In other words, they're in the no man's land where the thing can fall either way, and you cannot fault a man who would go either way because there are good policy reasons for going either way they might go. Now, I would like to call to your attention what is presently happening in some of the other states, and then I think I'm about done. Washington, to the north, has just established is in the act now of establishing an intermediate court authorized by the people. They got to the place where they were using, they have a regular, they're one of the five states in the United States that has a nine-man Supreme Court. They were using as high as 13 judges. And all you have to do is talk to some of the people up there to find out what they think about how a court that large, the efficacy of a court of that size. Also, probably the closest parallel to Oregon is the state of Colorado. I went back to Colorado to testify in front of their committee that was considering what they should do with the glut in their Supreme Court, because I've been working in connection with this plan, in connection with the bar and the court. The state of Colorado made my way back there to testify in front of the committee concerning what we were doing so we could consider that along with other things. And they are almost an exact parallel to us. They have exactly 2 million people. They have about 750,000 of them living in the Denver area, and the balance of the state are pretty widely dispersed, with some areas of the state being real sparsely settled as our eastern origin. They came out by establishing a full-scale intermediate court of appeals for their state. And they were admittedly further behind than we are. They were approximately 2 years behind this time. We haven't gotten that far behind. The beauty of the, seems to me, of the plan that's being presented to you is the fact that we do not force upon the taxpayer any more extra expense than is absolutely necessary at the present time, and we have built a structure which can logically be enlarged as the necessity requires. In other words, it's contemplated, I think, by everyone that has studied this system, that in the future, as the caseload gets greater, that new banks, additional banks of three people will be added to the Intermediate Court of Appeals, and another fraction of the jurisdiction be transferred over, and that eventually, when the state gets large enough and the volume of litigation becomes sufficiently heavy, that there will be a intermediate court straight across the board, same as they have in California now. Of course, that's in the future, but at least there is a structure which lends itself logically to this sort of an enlargement, which is not so if you just start out enlarging the Supreme Court, because I don't think anybody would advocate that ultimately we're going to have 30 or 40 Supreme Court judges. No one has ever done this, and I think that good reasons for not doing it. Now, we ran into another thing that might be interesting to you gentlemen in this way. When the bar started in to study this matter, there was some comment relative to setting aside a separate criminal court as part of a Supreme Court or as an intermediate body to appeal to the Supreme Court. We needed to end in the difficulty. The first thing was, it didn't pass 2 years ago. Secondly, there's a greater need now than there was 2 years ago. Third, we were getting our guff from the civil rights people. They were saying, and perhaps with some justification, we do not so much care if you route criminal cases to the intermediate court, as long as some civil jurisdiction goes with them. Because our experience elsewhere has led us to believe that when criminal jurisdiction is set off by itself, that it tends to be downgraded, and that when it goes hand in hand with civil law, it does not. And this was the view that was expressed to the bar. I might say that it is, of course, contemplated that these four divisions or types of cases that will first go to the intermediate court, they are criminal cases, post-conviction, which amount to, on a seven-year study, substantially 26% of the entire court work. The criminal and post-conviction, 26%. Actually, it's running about a third now, Senator, but this is on a seven-year average of 26%. And it's a little hard to prognosticate what the criminal business is going to be in the future. Our figures indicate that it's hit a plateau, that it's gone up to a certain level in the last 3 years. It's been about level across, but it hasn't dropped it. It's remained the same. And the second classification was probate and guardianships, which amounted to approximately 3% of the business. This is all on a seven-year study. Domestic relations, including adoptions, which amounts to approximately 6%, 5.9 to be exact. State agencies, excluding those tax commission matters, we excluded them because we already go to the tax court and an opinion is written that we didn't think there was any use of routing them into the intermediate court, amounts to 5-7, approximately 8%. All told, this runs slightly in excess of 40%, about 42%. Also, bear in mind that appeals from this intermediate court to the Supreme Court will only be made at the option of the Supreme Court. And that the record on appeal by statute is made the briefs in the intermediate court, the petition for rehearing in the intermediate, and this is your record on appeal. In other words, we tried to make it so that it would be a relatively inexpensive proposition by using those documents that are already in existence and would necessarily be in existence even in the intermediate court. Statistically, it's interesting to see what numbers of appeals are entertained by courts who have the choice to reject them. They run all the way from 3% to 13% throughout the United States, with the average being between 6 and 7%. And the court is hopeful that we can about hit the average. This would mean that out of every 100 cases appealed to the intermediate court, that somewhere around 6 or not more than somewhere around 6 or 7 would result in an appeal that would be entertained by the Supreme Court. I think that's all I have to say, unless you gentlemen have some questions. I might also add that Arizona, New Mexico, and these are established intermediate courts, along with Colorado and Washington. Can't think of anything else.
Any questions, Senator Lynn?
Question. Say something, ask you for a response. I think it was fairly known that there's some talk, quite a bit of talk, by lay people, by lawyers who have talked about it, that if this passes and the Supreme Court backlog is cut down, there's some talk that the maximum 4 years, not maybe as early as 2. Legislature might do the thing to say that you've never done, to move away from public office, and letting a couple of Supreme Court positions be abolished and expire. I think it's fair that you should know that that has been discussed. And I just wonder if you have any response to it.
I don't have any response to it, and I think it would be a perfectly proper thing to do if at the time that indicated that the positions were unnecessary. It doesn't offend me if the statistics at the time show that that's what's necessary. I don't believe you should have any more people than it takes to do the job, for sure.
I think that's not just anything to do with the idea that the work of the intermediate court, the personnel of the intermediate court does so, so said that perhaps the Supreme Court can then be working on to a 5-man court at the top.
And if this can be done, I don't see any reason why it shouldn't be.
Any further questions? No, thank you very much, Justice. Mr. Schwab?
My name is Herbert Schwab, Horton. I'll try not to recover ground that's already been covered. The question seems to be, really, whether the Supreme Court should be enlarged or whether a court of appeals should be created. Practically everybody seems to be agreed that additional appellate judicial manpower is needed. I served almost a year on the Supreme Court as a Justice Pro Tem over 3 years ago, and at that time, the court was overloaded. There were 9, including the pro tems on the court. We had to put out an average of well over 40 opinions per year to keep even, and the effort of trying to keep up with the opinions of the other 8 makes it almost impossible to make sure that these are more than one-man opinions. The problem of the appellate court sitting in departments is not a new one. 20 years ago, the Supreme Court of Oregon was sitting in departments. And on the same day, in 2 different departments, as you lawyers recognize, they handed down 2 opinions, one in each department. And one opinion said Oregon follows the rule of Rivals versus Fletcher, strict liability for artificially impounded waters, which is not the general rule in the United States. The other department said we do not follow that rule, and those 2 cases stand until this day. They plagued me in a case I was working on recently, but fortunately, we settled it. Now, the arguments against the Court of Appeals, rather than enlarging the Supreme Court, seem to grow out of a legitimate concern that the cost to county, to state, and to litigants will be greater, that more time will be consumed for the litigants, and that there will be second-grade justice dispensed in the Court of Appeals. So far as cost is concerned, most criminal cases are appeals at the expense of the counties, because I assume that over 90% of them are indigent appeals, and I have an appeal as a matter of right. Well, I believe it a fair statement that the largest single cost of the appeal in criminal case of any consequence is the transcript. Now, the way this bill is set up, as I understand it, and Justice Holden has pointed out, be one transcript, obviously. There'll be one set of briefs. The petition for a rehearing in the appellate court, if it's denied, will serve as a petition for certiorari, or whatever it's going to be called, to the Supreme Court. Now, it will be exactly the same, I suppose, as a petition for rehearing in the Supreme Court is today. If the appellate court, if the Supreme Court grants the petition, unless it asks for briefs, additional briefs, the only additional expense that would be involved would be the oral argument of the counsel at the time. If the Supreme Court doesn't deny certiorari, as I assume it will do in the vast majority of cases, there will be no increase in expense. But at least the criminal defendant will have had the chance of having another seven people, hopefully sitting in a bank and not in apartments. I think that would be a desirable result, something that the Supreme Court very rarely sit in apartments to sit in there. So at least that criminal defendant will have had the chance of having his case heard and decided by the five-man court of appeals, and then another look taken at it by a new seven-man group. But as I point out, unless the Supreme Court grants certiorari, there's no additional expense. If it does grant certiorari, the only additional expense, except in rare cases, I assume, would be the oral argument. Now, so far as that covers, I think, the matter of cost and time. So far as cost to the state is concerned, if you're going to add five judges at some level, adding them to the Court of Appeals with the same clerk, same library, same building, same everything, will be a little bit less expensive than adding the Supreme Court, which is, as I understand it, the potato indicates $1,000 less for those people. It's an infinitesimal amount, but I can't see that the cost would be greater than Court of Appeals and would be an added like number to the Supreme Court. So far as the second grade justice is concerned, I think they're just different judges. I don't think I could use a little second grade justice. I've been respondent in three cases in a row in the Supreme Court, and I've been reversed every time. in any event, I think the fact that the Supreme Court will have another look and reconcile differences between departments will tend, if anything, to upgrade the standards and quality and give the people who go through the Intermediate Court of Appeals maybe a better break. Now, as Justice Holman has pointed out, this Court of Appeals is a statutory court. The legislature can change its jurisdiction if it's very successful. If it wants to enlarge the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals, they do, as Senator Rent suggested, if they're dropping manpower in the Supreme Court, all of them will be eliminated soon. It can add to its jurisdiction, or if it finds that it isn't working and prefers to enlarge the Supreme Court, it can do that. It would seem to me that the Court of Appeals, as it is set up in this bill, is the most flexible approach to the problem, leaves the legislature with more room for change, sees that change is desirable, and holds, I think, a good deal of promise of being an effective answer to the problem. All I have,
Senator.
Any questions? Senator
Wilder? One of the problems we're talking about is time to draw. The judgment is rendered in the circuit court to a time it's fine. How much time does it take? What's the average now?
I don't know what it's up to now. It was down to about, when it's five, it's very difficult to say. Because,
I can answer that question.
Well, you mean the average, Justice Perry?
The average, we take up criminal cases as fast as we can. I would say, setting aside the delay between the time that the appeal is perfected, the briefs are in, that they're heard. Approximately 2 months after they're in that position. Now, if it's a civil case, it's probably out week after it's heard. If it's one that presents some problems, as some of them do, it could be over quite a period of time, as everybody is that interested in studying the case and have it first and everybody else on it.
Is there any average at the present time?
I don't think we haven't worked out an average on that, but we do give them preference as we're supposed to under the statute.
They vary a great deal, but my own experience on the court has been that the more people you have on the court, whether they're sitting in the apartments or not, the more time you're consuming reading other people's opinions if you're going to have them join the court, my opinion. And the more time you consume the argument in conference, I think the ultimate ideal, assuming growth like California all the time, are appellate courts, which can either be geographic when you get to several of them, or subject matter jurisdiction. The legislature can adjust that if it sees how the thing develops. And then a Supreme Court, no larger than seven, certainly, that ideally would never sit in anything but in bank. That would be the idea, I would think.
Time is important. That's one of the things we're talking about. Yeah. All of it. In terms of time, how would you contrast the time it takes now to get an appeal heard and decided with the time it would take if you had a third tier? In other words, what you're concerned about is the fact, among other things, that it's longer from the time of argument until the time of decision. But it would be longer still if you had another tier.
No, I think it's short. Because I think this Court of Appeals is the specialization, and it should not be a court of last resort. First of all, you're going to have five more people to divide the cases. So you're going to have five more people to whom to assign cases. You're going to have a Court of Appeals with only five to agree upon an opinion and get it out. And it's going to move much more rapidly because it'll have a smaller caseload per man, obviously, than the Supreme Court does now. And it will have a more specialized function. It's going to get them out on Saturday, right? Faster than you're going to be able to with fewer manpower and all cases going into one court. Right. Now it becomes a question of the Supreme Court.
It becomes a question of the next year.
All right. Right now, if you think bad, obviously bad, you petition for rehearing. 20 days in which to petition for rehearing. The Supreme Court, petition to the Supreme Court is the same, provides the same thing. You have 20 days in which to file with the Supreme Court. But if the Supreme Court is going to grant cert, that's going to take some more time. Granted, but just the time to present the oral argument, and the court's going to have a lot less business than it has now before it's been centralized. So it's going to get there. Get to its cases much quicker. It's not going to have to wait for briefs. The briefs are all in, the records are all in. It could grant a search and hear the case next week. It's studied it, and if it follows the pattern of most college courts, it's not going to grant cert unless it thinks there is a serious question about it.
In terms of some of the states that have recently gone to a court of appeal system, which are some of the other size, do we have any knowledge of how long the process normally takes from the point that the loser in the Court of Appeals or petitions to serve for the time the Supreme Court grants it and decides to place
it?
I think it depends on whether or not the Supreme Court accepts acceptance. It's governed from state to state depending upon what the requirements are in the Supreme Court as far as filing additional briefs or anything like that. The vote from 100 hours, making the record in the intermediate court, your record on appeal, that we won't have the necessary wait for additional briefs and things in any accepted occasion of the case, which means that it should be smoothed out and, arguments have to be set and have to be assigned and written for another 4 or 5 months at most. In the cases, in the cases where there is, where the court does not accept the petition, of course, it shouldn't be the one restriction.
No, I'm certain of one thing from my experience, that 2 5-man courts, for example, can turn out more cases faster than 1 10-man, because then if you're going to have a court of appeals rather than a bunch of appellate judges, you're going to read everybody else's opinions with great care. And so if you add, when you add people to the Supreme Court, you get beyond a certain point, it becomes a self-defeating proposition.
We found that in the committee here. You got a 5-man committee, why you can go through a ward much faster than you have a 7 or 9-man.
I'm not being facetious, and I was not instructed to say this, but I would think that if the Court of Appeals system worked so well, and people would like it so well, if the Court of Appeals would have general jurisdiction, there might be nothing wrong, though, with cutting the Supreme Court.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that.
Senator Burns. Judge Schwab, how far away do you see a general intermediate court appeal in our officers' clients' jurisdiction? How many years?
Well, I don't know, Senator Burns. You can't tell, because you can't tell what the United States Supreme Court is going to do from day to day. You know, they've added tremendously to the role.
Today,
it
involves residence requirements as well.
Yes, I heard. They've added quite a load, and I think properly so, to my criminal appeals for all indigents. All right, now one of these days, they're going to get rid of that petty offense rule and say if it's a jailable offense, you have a right to counsel and a right to jury trial and so forth. And that's probably going to increase the load. I don't know what they're going to do in the matter of juveniles, the right of juveniles to jury trials and so forth. We've got to follow those rules. The Supreme Court of Oregon, with all respect to the justices here, has become sort of an intermediate court of appeals in criminal matters now. They go to the district court. Judge Solomon has cut down the number of them by holding his hearings in the penitentiary in Salem rather than bringing the people out to the fresh air and arrive at Portland. That has cut down the number of habeas corpus petitions, at least, but there are still a lot. I can't answer your question. I would say, I would guess that it would be 10 years off.
Now, with regard to the cost of the briefs, you've got a complicated case that goes to the intermediate court. You're arguing violence versus Fletcher. You believe your back situation is square on the table. The intermediate court comes out with an opinion that says that you're out in the field. So you rephrase your contention in your petition for a rehearing, and they come down again. They deny your petition for rehearing. You think they've done it arbitrarily. Do you think, really, that you're doing justice to your client if you rest on the briefs that you filed and don't set it out again in your petition for rehearing?
Yes, I really do. Because, as a matter of fact, most lawyers, we're advocates. We also are professionals, and we very rarely, I think the experience of most lawyers around this table is that we really very rarely file a petition for rehearing. We see the opinion, and we'll grumble and holler, but we know that most of the time it's right, or at least it's a legitimate point of view, and one of these no-man-land questions, and the court's decided it, and that's the end of it. We now file a petition for rehearing in which we really think we're aggrieved, if we really think we're aggrieved, and we set forth in that petition, we certainly put our best foot forward in saying why they should reverse it. Now, if it's going to be a second-rate bite at the apple, it'll be only because the lawyers make it that way. If the petition for rehearing really sets forth what they think is wrong with the opinion, that ought to serve as the petition for cert. There's no reason why it shouldn't.
Assuming that I'm representing an indigent in a criminal case, and he wants me to file a petition for cert, setting it out,
I think this bill provides, oh, sorry.
Oh, well, no. And I say, well, no, the Supreme Court says that petition for rehearing suffices. I can't do that. Do you foresee any constitutional problem with the Supreme Court of the United States saying that you didn't fulfill your responsibility to your client?
As a matter of fact, I think this bill, if I'm not mistaken, provides that the petition for a rehearing is a petition for cert. And I don't.
You think that's okay?
I certainly do. I mean, otherwise, you're saying, in effect, that the lawyer is not doing a good job in the first place. He's not really. I mean, he's stating his grounds, and I would assume that he would state his grounds just as forcefully to the Court of Appeals as he would to the Supreme Court. And then he's just having two courts take a look at it. I can't see how he could legitimately say he could add anything. Now, certainly he could. He could add something to the petition for rehearing that he didn't put in his brief because of the opinion. But once he's seen the opinion, his petition for rehearing and his brief are available, and you would think he at that time has put his best foot forward, and there it is, all laid automatically in the lap of the Supreme Court. The clerk of the Supreme Court of Appeals puts on his Supreme Court hat and moves it over.
I want to ask you another question, last one, on a little bit different tack, and I do so advisedly because it may point in the direction of someone who I'm very fond of personally, and I don't intend in that manner, but there's a provision in the bill for appointment of retired judges pro tem, and we're moving more and more in the direction of a younger judiciary, and certainly anybody that's conversant with the Jake answer smile.
I used to say that too.
And anybody that's conversant with the load that the courts are carrying knows that it's increasingly a young man's job. What about perpetuating this tradition that we have of making provisions for retired judges and serving?
I think there are good arguments on both sides. One argument, now, I'd like to point out that same provision applies to the Supreme Court.
Yes, correct.
And I assume that your question is addressed just not to the Court of Appeals.
No. I mean, so often we become a creature of habit and we put something in the new bill because it's in the present statutory language. And I like to think that when we come up with.
Well, let me say this, Senator Burns, that if we were going to be consistent, we would not allow anybody over the age of 75 to serve as a judge pro tem, because we say, and people have said, that at age 75, you must retire. Now, if you must retire because of your age, it would seem to me that you should not allow a person then to serve beyond that age as a pro tem. Now, there's a good argument also for saying when a man feels he should retire, then he shouldn't serve. The arguments to the contrary are that there's a lot of difference between people. We face that. I used to face that a lot when I was on the school board. There are teachers that are senile at 60. There are others that are first grade at 65. Now, we took the cowards way out of important. We retired them all at 65. And we kept them all until they were 65. I don't know how to resolve that, but I would certainly say that if the mandatory retirement age is 75, and I know Judge Lust served long and well after that, and he was an exception that indicates why you should not make these rules. But there is a lot to be said. The mandate of the people was 75 minutes, and it might also be so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman. If the Supreme Court allows a review, is this limited to the errors you specifically set out in the hearing?
It can't be, really, in a criminal case. If they find a flagrant error.
Well,
yes.
Citing it.
Yes, it would be. If they find a flagrant error, they're required by a federal case to take a look at it, the federal court will. But normally, it would be.
Let me spell out
the matters. spelled out, but you have the benefit of it as part of the appeals opinion. You try to point out where the Court of Appeals is wrong. The Court of Appeals said, no, I'm right. You just take that same thing and say to the Supreme Court, first, I want to have a petition for certiorari. The Supreme Court then reasons. And if it says petition denied, as it will in most of the cases, or the whole thing reduces, that's the end of it. It's petition granted. It'll be unless.
Thank you, Bert. Randall Tester.
My name is Randall Tester. I'm a lawyer from Portland. I'm vice chairman of the Bar Committee on Judicial Administration. I'm appearing here on behalf of that committee and of the Oregon State Bar. Chairman of the committee, George Lehman, was unable to be here because of the meeting of the Court of Higher Education. He asked me to be here and report on the action of the Oregon State Bar. This matter, as you know, has been considered over quite a period of time. And in the 1968 annual meeting of the Oregon State Bar, membership voted approval of the Intermediate Court of State Appeals proposals. Based upon a report of the Committee on Judicial Administration of the State Bar. The bill which is before you is not actually the bar bill. This is the one that was submitted a request to the Judicial Council, but they're substantially the same. When this came in, the bar elected not to put another one in on the same subject, but just to go along with this one because they are, for all practical purposes, identical. I don't wish to repeat matters which have already been covered very ably, but there's one thing that occurred to me in listening to the previous discussion that perhaps might be supplemented, and it relates in a way to the question that Senator Burns asked about how long it might be before this term would have to be expanded, and possibly also to Senator Lynch's comment about perhaps ultimately being able to reduce the size of the present Supreme Court. This matter was considered by an interim committee back in 57-59. The interim committee was set up by the 57 legislature and the court of the 59 legislature. I served on that committee, the same one that Justice Holman mentioned. I was at that time serving on the state Supreme Court and had some personal experience with things that have been discussed here today. But in the report of the interim committee, there was an attempt to forecast the future workload of the state Supreme Court. I may say that at that time they were faced with the same problem of docket congestion that we have now. And at that time, caseload, and this refers to cases actually having to be decided, not the number of appeals, but the number of cases that were actually decided by opinion, ran about 200. And in 56, it was 208. In 1960, it was 219. I don't know if the 60 figure of 219 was a forecast because this came out in 59, but it was pretty well established. But the last previous figure in this report on 56 was 208 opinions per year. They attempted to forecast the number that would be required in the future. And they came up with figures that in 65 would be 238, in 70 would be 258, in 75, 282. Well, the figures that Justice Holman has given shows how far we have outstripped the anticipated workload that's projected at that time, because now we're already at over 300, whereas according to this prediction 10 years ago, we would only be at 258 by 1970. This shows the difficulty of trying to predict what the future workload is going to be. Now, this increased load, increased rate of increase, is of course due not merely to the growth of the state, but as has been previously indicated, to additional problems created by decisions of the United States Supreme Court, which have opened up new areas of review of criminal cases. And at the same time, the decisions which have
required furnishing of counsel of public expense in many cases that were not previously done, and there's no way to anticipate what other areas of jurisdiction might be open in the future. So this is highly speculative. Now, there's one thing that I would like to second very heartily about the alternatives available, and I think everyone's agreed that something has to be done, and it boils down pretty much to the question of either having intermediate court or expanding the membership of the present court. And incidentally, in the interim committee report back in 1959, it was proposed that at that time two additional judges be added to the state Supreme Court rather than going to an intermediate court. And the report recognized that it might become necessary to go to an intermediate court sometime in the future, but felt that it was not, the state was not yet ready for it at that time. And with the caseload then prevailing, it was anticipated that two more judges on the Supreme Court would have been adequate. A nine-judge court at 30 opinions would have been 270, which is right in line with their projection of caseload, which, as I say, has been outstripped. Well, if, and also I digress just a moment to say that at the same time, the constitutional amendment permitting use of pro tem judges was before the people, and this report recommended that. And by the use of pro tem judges, the court has in effect been expanded to nine rather than seven, so in effect got the results that were recommended by the interim committee report. But that, of course, is not adequate now. When you go to a larger Supreme Court, and if we were to add five to the seven now and go to a 12-man court, which would be necessary to get 360 opinions per year, you would inevitably run into the problem of one-man opinions. And this, I think, is very serious to the jurisprudence of the state, because a great deal of the time of the court is taken up by each judge reviewing the opinions of all the other judges. And it is bad enough for one judge to have to review all of the opinions of the other six judges, or there are pro tem sitting, the other seven or eight judges. But if he had to review the opinions of 11 other judges, it would take so much of his time that the practical result would be that he would not give the careful attention to the reviewing of the other judges' opinions that he should do, because in justice to the cases that were assigned to him for opinions, if he's going to keep up his own workload, he just wouldn't have the time to study carefully the opinions of all the other judges. And the result would be that he would just have to give them a cursory study, perhaps let things go, that if he had more time, he'd be inclined to challenge and perhaps dissent and maybe require a further study by the other members of the court. But as you get larger and larger, you'd have less and less time for that, and the result would be inevitably that opinions would come out that were substantially the work only of the judge who wrote the opinion and did not have the careful scrutiny of all the other members of the court. And this would get us back to what I've referred to as one-man opinions, as, and all of you who practice law know, felt that one-man opinions are not good for the jurisprudence of the state. Now, you'd have the same problem in resolving interdepartmental conflicts if you went to a 12-man court, the Supreme Court, operating in departments. As has been pointed out, you would inevitably have some conflicting opinion between departments. The normal process for resolving such conflicts would be by a petition for rehearing before the entire court and bank. But then the situation would be that you'd be the same judges who had already differed. Department A had come up with a yes answer, Department B had come up with a no answer. You put the two departments together in bank, you'd still be inclined to have the same judges voting the same way in trying to resolve the question, and the result would be that the Chief Justice would be sitting as, in effect, an arbitrator, a mediator, or the referee deciding between the two departments. So So in effect, you'd be getting one-man decisions from the Chief Justice who would be resolving these conflicts. Now, if you have conflicts in the departments of an intermediate court, and then those go to the Supreme Court for resolution, then you have an entirely fresh panel who have not previously taken a position on the issue, and you'd be much more likely to get sound jurisprudence than if you were leaving it up to, in effect, the Chief Justice to decide the basic policy on those cases which necessarily would be the most difficult cases. Now that, I believe, is all that I have to add to what's been said. The State Bar, I represent, is in favor of the Intermediate Court proposal, and is there any questions?
Any questions? Not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jake Tanzer.
Mr. Chairman, any members? My name is Jake Tanzer. Here, because the primary immediate effect of the bill would be upon the body of criminal law, and having to be where I spend my time. I'm the Deputy District Attorney in Multnomah County, so I don't report to speak to the office, but I handle the appeals of criminal cases to the Supreme Court. I'm not here as a matter of sour grapes, unlike Mr. Schwab. I do manage to win a good portion. I also have the chairman of the criminal law committee of the State Bar, although I don't speak for the bar. And I speak from long-standing interest because I was a member of the Levin Committee, which is chaired by Phil Levin, who drafted the request of the Judicial Council and drafted the initial legislation, 1967 legislation, upon which the present bill is based. And in some sense, I'm apparently the villain of the piece. I handle, actually, in my capacity, out of Multnomah County, some 10% of the appeals handled by the Supreme Court, which accounts for some 40% of criminal cases in this state. So, I come because I have some knowledge of the area and because I will be very much affected. My work will be very much affected. And, the committee should be thankful that I did spend my time back there crossing out things I was going to say, as other speakers said, but I'll try not to be repetitious. In general, it's just very obvious, summarizing, that the legal business of the state is now simply too big for the Supreme Court, and it's too small for a generalized court of appeals. And some, at least stopgap measure has to be made if development of law is to retain its quality and its expedition. And the number of cases is going to grow for obvious reasons generally, but particularly in the criminal area, the cases will multiply. When we were first working with Phil Evans' committee, I remember Justice Goodman came to say that he felt that probably the criminal cases were going to taper off now because they pretty well handled most of the post-conviction cases, and the law has finally become fairly fixed. Well, I'm glad that that sort of error of judgment has not crept into many of his opinions, because during the two-year interval, the Supreme Court of the United States has come down with Andrews versus California, which guarantees as a matter of constitutional right the non-meritorious appeal to the defendant, and swelled the number of appeals. Countless cases, not countless, but many cases have come down in areas of confession, search and seizure. And it seems to me that the Supreme Court of the U.S. constantly generates new work. It has during the 2 years. Also, the crime rate has gone up. There are going to be more criminal prosecutions. The right to appeal by an indigent, while it has not expanded since Andrews versus California, is better known. It is getting better known. County, an awful lot of the convictions are appealed. I can't give you a percentage. It's reaching the majority of convictions. And in other counties, I'm told by the DAs that they're now handling their first appeals. They've not had many before. The word is sort of spreading. So there are going to be more cases, more criminal cases particularly. And an already overburdened Supreme Court can't handle them and do them justice. long-term solution is needed. With Phil Levin's committee, I think we considered just about all the alternatives that we could conjure, and we came up with two solutions, of which there was little preference one way or the other. The one ultimately adopted was the Intermediate Court of Appeals, at that time specializing in criminal law. The burdens, the increase of the burden in the last 2 years has led the proponents to expand it beyond criminal law to probate and domestic relations and domestic appeals. Now, I've heard many objections expressed, reservations, by the committee members during the meeting here today, the hearing, and also by other members. And I think that some of the reservations expressed, well, I should say that they are the same reservations that we thought of and considered during the deliberations of that committee in drafting this legislation. And we decided either upon full reflection, the objection had a little weight, or it was counterweighted by other factors which were more than equal important. We considered this problem, for example, of inconsistency of opinions between panels. And we came to the conclusion that some inconsistency, perhaps, where you have many departments operating, is simply a given evil with which you can do well. If a court of appeals had many departments, there would be some inconsistency. You can look to courts such as the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia and the Federal Circuit, or that one in particular, where you find different rules emanating from different panels. The nice thing about this situation is that at least the Supreme Court is more accessible for review of such inconsistencies than is such a court available in the federal system. The Supreme Court takes a few cases. The inconsistency can be fought, though, in some other ways, which I shall mention. There would be inconsistency to the same degree, however, if the Supreme Court were expanded and itself had to operate in departments, and there would be no recourse from an expanded Supreme Court panel, no reasonable recourse. So, with an intermediate court, inconsistencies would be resolved, which would not necessarily be under a different system. We were impressed with the idea of an intermediate criminal court of appeals. And this is more. This is criminal plus some other subject areas, but principal. Not as a final solution, but rather as sort of an empirical stopgap tool. Now, 6 years, 10 years from now, the state is going to need more. So the business is going to be increased, and some other remedy is going to be needed. At least with an intermediate criminal court, when that time comes, we'll have some experience instead of shooting in the dark, like the legislature is doing now. We'll know whether a specialized court, for example, a series of specialized courts is the answer. Whether it's a court broken up into districts by geographical area, whether it should be one single court sitting in flexible departments. 10 years from now, I would assume the problem is going to be, if nothing were done, of course, would be of rather monstrous proportions. At least with some experience in the interim, the legislature can make wise and informed decisions when that time comes. And this is one way of turning it. It has blessings of all the various systems, and as was commented earlier, which I won't repeat, it has the flexibility which no other system really provides. I hear a reservation expressed regarding delay. I doubt that the delay would be much greater than it is today if the hopes of the legislation are achieved and the courts are brought current. If courts are brought current and the hearing is more immediate upon briefing, and the decision is more immediate upon after hearing, then I would think that the bulk of legislation would be heard much sooner and decided much sooner than it is today. And I might add that in criminal law particularly, many of the cases are not, many of the defense lawyers are not terribly interested in what our Supreme Court does at all. This is a waste step on the way to federal court. And the thing that we considered was the decision upon that rather cursory petition for rehearing would be considered a final decision by the state courts, which allowed them to get into federal court without going through the entire rigmarole of rehearing. Some have criticized it, and I notice that's true of the editorial the other night. Due to the segregation of certain cases for consideration, for two-step consideration, and people have pointed to this as a failing of the bill in various ways. In all candor, you know, that bothered us a great deal too. But then we tried to look at it in a different way. I think that after thinking about it, it may well be a blessing. The reason that I say it may be a blessing is this. I'm looking again to my particular area of the law. And the law is growing, it is changing, it is expanding, it is moving, and it's to the point where I think to really stay on top of it requires expert, sort of specialized expertise. And then I think the consideration of such cases by judges who have developed expertise by dealing with a great number of the cases would contribute to the building of a really solid body of law. It is growing too fast, I think, for generalists to really do adequate justice to it. And many of you lawyers on the committee who have defended a criminal case recently, I think, know what I mean. It's taken you a great deal more work to get prepared to do an adequate job than would somebody who's in the business continually. Well, there is the opportunity for, I think, a flowering in the criminal law area, and there is also one other factor to consider, and that is, and another reason for the increase in cases. 2 years from now, hopefully the Criminal Law Revision Commission will issue its report, and again, hopefully, the legislature will adopt a new criminal code in the state of Oregon. And I know the commission is considering also the, besides substantive code, a new procedural code in criminal cases. There will be hundreds of cases brought, which will be necessary to bring further definition to the law, explanation, resolution. And I suggest that that is best done by somebody who, by a court which handles a great bulk of criminal cases. Many of the decisions will not be the sort of policy considerations which one envisions a Supreme Court concerning itself with, but mechanical, practical, everyday, nuts and bolts decisions which are not necessary, must be tested out and resolved. Balancing, it seems to me, a specific review of our judges with some expertise and policy review by the generalists and the Supreme Court seems to be an excellent balance. There's been some reluctance regarding the bill because of the use of pro tems and the idea that the elimination of pro tems would allow funds to then create this court as a experiment. The use of pro tems is still allowed in the bill. Well, I would only say that some pro tems are going to be needed in the first biennium to clear out the backlog. Later, pro tems are going to be necessary because the number of cases is going to increase, and there has to be some way of handling it before the legislature, 10 years from now, let's say, steps on to a new, to an expanded or changed system to accommodate a greater number of cases. Costs are minimized into the system, and I won't go into that. I was interested in Senator Burns' comment about the desire for a younger judiciary. My thoughts were two. Number one, and it's usually younger lawyers who would yearn for a younger judiciary. And two, my thoughts also turned to Judge Lust, who at 85 or 84, when he asked a question, I knew the case was just about to be decided. Have been. There's not a sharper mind on the court. Again, that sort of thing can handle the flexibility. tried to point out, I think, that in terms of time used, in terms of quality of decision, in terms of necessity, and in terms of flexibility for the future, the bill is desirable. And something is necessary, whether it be this or something else. However, at least in my opinion, that argument is the best solution. That's all I have in this debate.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That will conclude the hearing on House Bill 1195. Representative Carson has come in. He is on House Bill 1405.
That man was here a few minutes ago, too, by the way. I don't know if they went out. Well, there he is.
Oh, I didn't even see it. Well, sorry.
That's fine. I've got to
go ahead, Wally. He's got some stuff to study.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Wallace Carson, Jr. from Graham County. 1405 is its attempt is to improve the area dealing with summons. It brought to my attention that there is a perhaps an inconsistency in our present system on what should be in a summons. If you look at the bill as amended, you'll see both 15.040 and 15.050, which is perhaps underneath your amendment. The bill originally was designed to remove the necessity of, in a law action, of stating the two elements, the amount of the money, or the general phrase of relief as prayed for in the complaint, and substitute just the latter, and that is the summons will state that if you fail to answer the time set forth, that the plaintiff will apply to the court, and so on. Now, this would then conform the law action to what is now the process procedure in an equity matter. The in-house judiciary, after taking testimony and discussing it and working it around, we decided that we were still leaving an inconsistency in 040, and I was quite surprised to find it. In reading 040, you'll find that the summons states what the summons shall contain. It shall contain a number of things. The statement or judgment for want thereof will be taken against them. So you have the situation in a law action, you're supposed to put that in. Then 050 was a special section that said what else you were supposed to put in. I know of no one who put both in. They jumped and went to 050. Most summonses that I saw went to 050, ignoring, in my view, the dictates of 040. So rather than to extend this body of law, we eliminate our suggestion from House Judiciary, eliminates Section 050, which is the redundancy, and redesigns 040, saying now that merely that your summons shall state that he shall be required to appear and answer the complaint as in the section provided, or for want thereof, the plaintiff will apply to the court for the relief demanded therein. The effect is this would be true in both a law action and an equity suit. This is what your summons would say. And that's the form that it's passed House Judiciary and passed the floor of the House and before you gentlemen today. The purpose of that, of course, is to resolve the potential inaccuracies that may come from the statement of the summons that disagrees with the statement of the complaint, which I understand has happened on occasion. At least one of a difficult problem, which one of those fall upon. We feel that this is responsive approach to a relatively small problem of law, but nevertheless one that is meritorious. That's all I have.
I've never noticed that before. Husband, did you?
No. I knew.
It's come to your attention and in your practice.
But I've never known of any problems either.
No, Senator, I think that's probably true. I think I'm of the opinion that the court would be somewhat hesitant. We have the case of her legion where the court goes to great extents to, because summonses are merely notice, and if they can possibly find that the defendant got notice, they're going to hold the validity of the plaintiff if they can find it. It's where there's an inconsistency, where the problem that comes up. And we do know of cases in Marion County, none of which have reached the Supreme Court, where there's been an inconsistency between the summons and the complaint. And this has been a defect in the subject of the murder, I understand. But no, I would concur that this is...
It takes a default judgment as well. It says you can only take the default for what's in the summons, and if that's less than what's in the complaint, that's all that you have. Likewise, if the complaint was less than what was on the summons, it would be bound to a lesser of the two.
Well, I think this is a doozy, and the one thing I can say about it can't hurt anything.
Unlike most of my bills.
Any further questions? No, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And Representative Irving Mann is here on 1378.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Irving Mann from the 28th Lake District.
Where do you live, sir?
I live in Umatilla County.
What town?
Well, I don't live in a town, I live out in the country.
What closest to what town?
Oh, it's near Hermiston.
Danville?
Danville, Hermiston. Echo Triangle.
Okay, go right ahead.
Our minutes are down.
Mr. Chairman, I introduced this bill at the request of the Attorney General, District Attorney's Association, and it's particularly wanted by the attorneys, district attorneys in counties that have no district court, in particular, Herman Winter. And it very carefully provides that the jurisdiction of the amendments carefully provides that the jurisdiction of the JPs and counties that do have district courts are not changed in any way at all. And then the amendment on line 8 of the printed bill, insertion of in counties not having a district court, then there in those counties the jurisdiction or the powers of punishment are increased from 3 months to 1 year and from $100 to $500. And this is in no way an attempt to preserve the JP system or against the district court system, but rather in those few counties that don't have district courts, and we're lucky they don't have district courts, it would save the DA quite a little bit of trouble.
There are two sections to this, are there?
Yes, sir. It had to be written that way because the way it was written in the first place, it didn't do what it was supposed to do. It didn't define the jurisdiction of a JP in a county where the district court was the way it was written the first time.
Except as otherwise provided.
This is a restatement of the jurisdiction of the justice courts as it is now in courts where there are district in counties where there are district courts.
All right. And then you mentioned except as oh I see. Now this is except as otherwise provided in the jurisdiction so on in counties not having a district court. They will have jurisdiction. Punishment does not exceed increases from 3 months to a year. Fine $100 to $500 for both.
I understand that. It's a good deal.
Well, Mr. Chairman, so all that you're doing is that in counties that do not have a district court, the jurisdiction of the JP is
increased 1 year and $500. Any questions then on your excellent bill? Not thank you very much. Now the House Bill 1365, and would someone call Dr. Stan Davis? John, would you have your secretary call 2701 and ask Dr. Graham to come up also? Meanwhile, we'll hear Doc's name.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appear before you at the request of representatives of the Oregon Medical Association that I can't say that I appear as an advocate for them. At least in part because I'm not in a certain official position for the association being in this connection in connection with the House Bill 1365. But I am personally interested in proposing and attempting to persuade that the purposes of this bill are in the public interest. Go further to suggest that it is not intended, and as far as I can determine from reading the summary of the bill, it does not have the effect of in any way minimizing the viability of positions of those around them, insofar as the use of blood or other tissues is concerned in human disease. The purpose, the significance of it, as far as I understand, has to do with assuring that human blood for transfusion purposes, I particularly emphasize the blood. Same principle, it seems to me, hurt minds of our other tissues and organs are concerned, where they are used in the management of human disease and for the form of transplant and other should not be these materials, these tissues, blood one, should not be considered to be within the concept of things to be sold.